Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 7th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, we'll start with some housekeeping items. First off, could the unknown comrade who keeps sending me all the CDs of my Radio Free Northwest podcasts in the little white envelopes to the Seattle Post Office Box, please use the Port Orchard address instead? That post office box in the city is very small. Your envelopes are not marked fragile, and some of the compact discs are getting cracked. Now, secondly, I repeat, could all large and heavy boxes of books or whatever be sent to the Port Orchard address from now on and not to the Seattle Post Office box? Now, we finally got a vehicle over there and got that big box of books, and to be blunt, while I appreciate the comrade's gesture of friendship, the contents were not worth the effort. Guys, look, I know how this sounds, and I hate it. I know I come across sometimes as rude and dismissive and having a bad attitude, but I have to be straight with you. I have no need of your junk. Please don't dump it on me. I have no need of your cookbooks. I have no need of almanacs and reference books that are decades out of date. I have no need of British DVDs that will not play on American machines. I have no need of video cassettes. No one has a VCR anymore, although I am old-fashioned enough to maintain an audio cassette deck. I have no need of strange plastic objects that I have no idea what on earth they are. I once had to stand in line and fill out a customs form to get a package from some strange kid in Canada who sent me a hockey puck. What in God's name am I going to do with a hockey puck? Okay, let's wander on into the actual program here. Now, do you ever wonder what federal law enforcement is doing down on the border as the illegal aliens swarm into our country at the rate of thousands per day? Now, when they're not changing diapers on all those little brown bottoms from those little brown sweet peas who seem to have somehow crawled across the Rio Grande on their own, what do you think they're doing? Well, I'll tell you what the FBI is doing on the border. They're fabricating bogus criminal charges against Border Patrol agents in order to try and get them to turn informer. Now, in the latest FBI news, a joint FBI-IRS task force has just ended up with egg dripping down its face when a federal judge threw out an indictment brought by the FBI and the United States Attorney's Office in Southern Arizona on the grounds that the evidence was completely fabricated by the Bureau. The judge dismissed money laundering and corruption charges against Customs and Border Protection agent Lauro Tobias on Tuesday in response to the dismissal motions from both the Department of Justice and Tobias's attorney, which were filed within hours of each other on July 25th. Now, the case reeked of fabrication so bad that even the United States attorney had to run for cover. And given the extent to which these people have shown that they'll go in order to maintain manufactured prosecutions and things like the disgraceful Bill White affair, that's saying a lot. Of course, this Tobias guy probably had an actual defense attorney instead of a public defender. which is not the same thing. Now, the FBI spent thousands of taxpayer dollars on strippers, plane tickets, luxury hotel suites, champagne, steak and caviar dinners, and tickets to a boxing match with some Mexican fighter whose name I can't pronounce as part of their so-called investigation. Now, Tobias, I don't know whether he's Mexican or white, spent 10 years with the Border Patrol after doing a full 20 years in the Air Force. So the guy's an older man, he's a vet. He was arrested in March 2013 after he took a trip from Phoenix to Las Vegas, allegedly for a drug deal. 6 kilograms of cocaine were to be exchanged with unnamed persons for $100,000, and Tobias was supposed to be paid $4,000 for supposedly working as security during the deal. Now, Tobias has maintained that he did not know that the trip was for a drug deal, and he was assured that the exchange was legal. Okay, well, maybe, maybe not. But the thing is, the drug deal wasn't real. Literally, everyone involved, aside from Tobias, appears to have been part of the federal task force that had been attempting, with little success, to root out so-called corruption within the Border Patrol along the Arizona-Mexico border. Look, I am sure that like every other federal law enforcement agency, the Border Patrol probably is corrupt. Hey, we live in a democracy, and democracy breeds corruption and incompetence, period. End of story. Now, since the government and the society that the Border Patrol serves is corrupt from top to bottom, that's to be expected. Whoop-de-doo. But I suspect that in this case, the FBI's definition of corruption probably means opposing the collapse of the border and the flood of little brownies into this country, and maybe resisting or refusing orders from the dictatorship to cease enforcing immigration laws. And my guess is that most of the so-called corrupt Border Patrol agents they were after would just happen to be white, male, and registered Republicans. Now, the giveaway is the presence of the IRS on the task force. You know, the same IRS that the regime has been using to harass white people in general and the Tea Party in particular. The same IRS headed by a Jewish woman who lied and refused to answer questions in front of Congress, and who claims that tens of thousands of her emails over a period of years have just disappeared, and nothing has been done about it, and she hasn't been prosecuted. You know, that IRS? According to documents filed with the court, the federal task force, who were out to get this Border Patrol agent Tobias, put the fake drug deal into play, as well as supplying the money, the drugs, and the agents for various parts in the alleged conspiracy. In other words, the whole thing was a fabrication from beginning to end in order to entrap this one man and get him to turn informer. I repeat that both the defense and the prosecutors asked for a dismissal. The United States attorney probably screamed in horror when he saw how badly the Bureau had screwed the pooch, and he understood that he was expected to stand up in a courtroom and present a dog's dinner of complete and total FBI incompetence, lies, and criminality, and sell it to a judge in public, not hidden away in motions and in-chambers wheeling and dealing and plea bargaining and crap. He broke and he ran. The judge granted the motion with prejudice, meaning that this whole mess can never be brought up again, and it is to be buried. Now, this Tobias guy seems to have spent either 14 months in jail or else out on bail. That's not clear from the article. Tobias's attorney told BuzzFeed that federal agents tried to turn Tobias bad in order to use him as a mole at the border station. They framed a most likely innocent man in order to get him to turn informer on their real targets. Probably the aforementioned white male Republican higher-ups. In other words, business as usual at the Bureau. Okay, look, I gather by now that most of you figured out that this whole Who Guards the Guardians thing has sprung from my fairly well-known habit of online and DVD binge-watching certain idiotic but occasionally entertaining TV shows and movies, which deliberately portray federal law enforcement agents as steely-eyed heroes serving and protecting Obama's America against the forces of evil. I should add that I get the DVDs from Netflix or the bargain bin at Walmart for $1.99. I do not have cable TV, and I wouldn't waste my time and money on it. I'm talking about movies like Manhunter, Silence of the Lambs, and The Fugitive, and God knows how many more down through the years, but especially TV shows over the past 10 or 15 years designed to sanitize the FBI and federal law enforcement in general, like Profiler, 24, Bones, or the latest one, Justified, with a hillbilly U.S. Marshal gunfighter who's also a homicidal psychopath. But he's a good psychopath, kind of like a tobacco-chewing Dexter with a gun. Now, there's also CSI and The Mentalist and some others, although I know they're not federal. Basically, it all tends to the same thing, though. These are shows where it's pretty obvious that Hollywood's pushing a political agenda to sanitize and glorify some very nasty people and excuse their cruel, criminal, and deeply cowardly behavior. I frankly watch these shows on DVD or on my computer to fuel my rage and bolster my determination to bring these evil people and their whole world crashing down around their damned ears. Now, some of them aren't bad shows in themselves. I actually think 24 had its moments, like when the African niggers got in and trashed the White House. And I think that there were parts of that series which, if you think about them, were hysterically funny, although they probably weren't intended to be. Part of the covert agenda of 24, which began in the Bush years, was not just to project an image of high-tech omnipotence and invincibility. It was to accustom normal people to the idea of FBI and other federal agents from mysterious acronym agencies like CTU being able to torture people. To convince normal people that torture is a good thing so long as people with federal badges do it. By portraying them as flawed heroes, but heroes nonetheless. By displaying these human insects as strong-jawed and steely-eyed guardians of cute little kitties and beautiful women who are menaced by evil, ugly, villainous white men like you and me. Fatherly and motherly feminist protectors who violate the law in the United States Constitution and break other people's bones and shoot them in the head and burn them with electrical current because they just love us all so. Now, the way it worked out for me was that every season of 24 was a thrill to watch because you always wondered who Jack Bauer was going to torture next. All kinds of Muslims and Russians, of course, who were the primary bad guys on the series, and to give him his due, Bauer himself was usually tortured at least once during the season. But, let's see, if memory serves, and it's been years since I've watched the whole series, Jack Bauer tortured either a sitting president or an ex-president. I can't remember if the Charles Logan character was still in the office at the time. He tortured a senator's aide in the White House itself, in the room next to the Oval Office, with the president next door. He tortured a couple of his ex-friends and associates when they were allegedly doing bad acts. He shot his own boss through the head, but the bad guy made him do it, you see. He whipped out his gun in an interrogation room and shot a prisoner through the head with no provocation, but it was necessary because, you see, the prisoner had to die so Jack could go underground and take his place, so Jack just shot him. He tortured his own girlfriend when he thought that she was a spy, but later on they kissed and made up, which I'm sure had all the feminists on the plot development team spitting mad. I mean, this show at times was a hoot. I actually think Series 8, the final series, approached the level of truly great drama because it shows what that kind of power over other people does to the men who use it. The decay of their character that comes from the absolute power over life and death, such as is given to them by the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011. The power to destroy other people's lives without any accountability at all. Now, that kind of power exercised in the name of evil, which the United States government is, turns someone into Jack Bauer. At the end of his career, working for the glorious red, white, and blue, and fighting for truth, justice, and the American way, Bauer doesn't get to ride off into the sunset. He simply loses his mind. He goes berserk, and he just starts killing in the last part of the series, just outright murdering people, including disemboweling a Russian spy alive, and cleaning out the entire Russian embassy from the ambassador on down, and he just plain shoots his best friend's girlfriend through the head. Okay. She's a bad girl and she's been up to no good, but Bauer just kills her, standing in front of him, unarmed, begging for her life. There's no feminist karate fight or witty repartee or one-upmanship or anything like that, which is rare in television. Now, I am getting at something here. I mentioned that last bit because in the FBI, real life seems to be imitating fiction. Now, you remember in May 2013, about 15 months ago, when the FBI held a Chechen man named Ibrahim Todashev prisoner in his apartment in Florida for almost 12 hours. They interrogated him without a warrant, along with a couple of thugs from the Massachusetts State Police, and then they shot him 6 times in the front and finished him off with 1 shot to the back of the head while he was on the floor. No one quite knows why they did this. Apparently, he was telling them things about the Boston Marathon bombing that they decided he didn't need to be repeating to anybody. Anyway, the FBI agents were exonerated by the subsequent inquiry on grounds that were so flimsy that even the state-controlled media laughed their heads off. Now, when I heard about that, I wonder if those Phoebes in that Florida apartment had watched the final series of 24 and decided that they were Jack Bauer and they could just kill people. In this deranged and dysfunctional society, anything is possible. I mean, for God's sake, the latest case against Bill White is based on a Fox Network TV show called The Following. Millions of Americans are too dumbed down and confused to understand anymore that television isn't real. And that apparently includes at least one U.S. attorney in Florida. Why shouldn't the same thing apply to FBI agents? Now, I did notice that there was one taboo on the show which was always pretty much observed. The Bauer character never actually tortured a nigger. There were a lot of bad niggers, especially in that one episode where General Booga Booga did the White House. But Bauer just shot them, no torture. I think the show's producers were leery of showing scenes that might give us white boys mental images, that might plant seeds in our minds and get us to thinking about forbidden possibilities. But probably the show that enrages me more than almost anything else is one called Criminal Minds, because it has all the elements of pure propaganda and it doesn't seem to serve much of any purpose other than to falsely portray the FBI as heroes. The episodes, season after season, are all pretty much of a piece. I won't describe them, but frankly, it's boring. It even has a spinoff that starred that wall-eyed nigger Forrest Whitaker, although it was so inane that it only lasted a season or two. Criminal Minds purports to regale us with the adventures of the famous FBI profilers, who with their deep psychological insights into the criminal mind and the human condition protect us from the greatest threat to America's well-being of all, psycho serial killers. Do you realize that there are hundreds and thousands of psycho serial killers running around out there, all kidnapping pretty women and committing politically incorrect acts that we just must be protected from by giving up every single right we have under the Constitution? Well, Criminal Minds explains all that to you. And of course, almost all of these wicked evil serial killers are white males who prey on pretty white women and white children, of course. Jeez, I just looked at the little clock down in the lower right hand of the screen. I have rambled away a whole segment of this program, and I haven't even got to the main part yet. I'm sorry about that, guys. Look, tell you what, since we're talking about murderers here, here's a good old-fashioned ballad about a murder that took place in 1808 in Randolph County, North Carolina. This is Doc Watson.
Oh, listen to my story, I'll tell you no lies. How John Lewis did murder poor little Omi Wise. He told her to meet him at Adams's Springs. Said he'd bring her money and other fine things. So fool-like she met him at Adams's Springs. No money he brought her, nor other fine thing. Go with me, little Omi, and away we will go. Off to get married, and no one will. Fingers are cold. She climbed up behind him and away they did go, but off to the river where deep waters flow. John Lewis, John Lewis, will you tell me your mind? Do you intend to marry me or leave me behind? Little Omi, little Omi, I'll tell you my mind. My mind is to drown you and leave you behind. Have mercy on my baby and spare me my life. I'll go home as a beggar and never be your wife. He kissed her and he hugged her, then he turned her around and pushed her in deep waters where he knew that she would drown. He jumped on his pony and away he did ride, as the screams of little Omi went down by his side. Twas on one Thursday morning the rain came pouring down, when the people searched for Olmi, but she could not be found. Two boys went to fish in one fine summer day, and they saw little Olmi's body go floating away. Then they threw their net around her and drew her to the bank. Her clothes all wet and muddy, they laid her on a plank. They sent for John Lewis to come to that place, and they brought her out before him so that he might see her face. Though he made no confession, they carried him to jail. No friends nor relations would go on his bail.
Right, I've been rambling long enough, so let's get on with this week's episode of Quies Custodiet Ipsos Custodes? Who guards the guardians? How do the famous FBI profilers stack up in real life against their Hollywood counterparts? Now, this week, we get to profile the boys and girls of the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. Come on down.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. He makes another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
The Behavioral Science Unit of the FBI was founded in 1974 in order to catch serial sex offenders, which is a laudable goal in itself since most of them are black or brown. There have been half a dozen organizational and administrative splits and reconglomerations and re-coalescings and whatnot since then, and in 1997 the unit became the Behavioral Analysis Unit. Agents assigned to the BAU are supposed to have at least 15 years of field experience. But I found scuttlebutt on the net, which suggests that the BAU is basically a dumping ground for agents who are too lazy or weak or cowardly for field work, and their SAICs are looking for a desk at Quantico to unload them behind. Members of the BAU use a concept known as psychological profiling. Now, what you have to understand is that despite what you see and hear on TV, psychological profiling is not in any way, shape, or form an established science, and many professional psychologists think it's a load of crap despite 20 years of conditioning by Hollywood to accept it. It's been described by real shrinks as quote-unquote a form of voodoo and quote-unquote grossly overpriced and overhyped guesswork. Now, this next is from Wikipedia, which I admit is not the most reliable source in the world, but it says, and I quote, "In a number of studies, professional criminal profilers have been compared to other groups, such as students, police officers, and clinical psychologists. In order to evaluate these groups, each participant was participated with the details of a previously solved crime. The profile written by the participant was then compared to a profile of the guilty party. In no study did the group of profilers outperform the other groups, and in some studies they were clearly outperformed by both biology and chemistry students. Now, despite these findings, members of the BAU continue to use psychological profiling. Public confidence in psychological profiling is also high and has been greatly promoted by TV shows such as Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior. Some forensic psychologists have also dismissed the previously mentioned studies by stating that they lack external validity, and don't ask me what that is, as they do not truly represent the situations in which members of the BAU work. And what that is some asshole on the federal payroll telling the peasants to piss off and stop asking questions and quit messing with his paycheck. Okay, back to Wikipedia. Belief in psychological profiling has often been supported by anecdotal evidence describing BAU profiles as a necessary key to solving a crime. A homeless man in North Carolina, for example, was apprehended after a BAU profile was issued for a case that the local police force had not been able to solve. I'm not sure, they may be talking about the Eric Rudolph case there, in which case he was apprehended because he got so hungry he had to go diving in a dumpster looking for food and a local cop caught him. Although anecdotal evidence such as this abounds in popular media, i.e. shows like Criminal Minds, the concept of psychological profiling has not been empirically proven. Now, remember what I said about people confusing TV with reality. I don't seem to be the only one to have noticed that we live in a world where Bill White can be charged with a crime and imprisoned for life as a habitual criminal on the basis of a television show. So, cut to the chase. How many serial killers has the BAU actually caught in real life? Gee, there don't seem to be any statistics available that I could find on the net. Remember that anecdotal evidence I described just now? Doesn't look like the Bureau can come up with too much of that either. And by the way, I may be wrong here. If any of you can find any solid statistics on exactly how many of these BAU profiles work out, let me know. Okay, well, let's just do a cruise on the net and see who we can come up with in that time period. First off, did you know that the most prolific serial killers in the world come not from the United States, but from South America? The worst in the world is Luis Garavito, the man called La Bestia de Colombia, the Beast of Colombia, with 138 confirmed kills and suspected of almost 400, all children. At any given time, there seems to be about 100 of them wandering all over Latin America, although now that Obama's abolished the border, they're probably all coming here. But let's look at our real-life BAU's track record. The Zodiac in California was never caught despite extensive FBI involvement, but that was actually a little before the BAU's time, so fair enough, we can't really hang that failure on them as such. Son of Sam was caught by the NYPD due to a parking ticket that he got at a crime scene. Eileen Wuornos, who is the one non-black widow, non-poisoning female serial killer I'm familiar with, was arrested by local police in Florida at a biker bar in Volusia County when she was ratted out by her lesbian lover. Hillside stranglers Angelo Buono and Kenneth Bianchi were busted by local police, Buono in Los Angeles and Bianchi in Bellingham, Washington. When Bianchi's dark urges overcame him and he tried killing without his partner to clean up after him. Ted Bundy was arrested for the first time in August of 1975 by a Utah Highway Patrol officer in Granger, a Salt Lake City suburb, and this was after Bundy failed to pull over for a routine traffic stop. The cop found all kinds of killing gear in his car, rope and duct tape and plastic bags and so forth. A local detective then hooked up with the Seattle PD and the King County Sheriff, and they realized that Bundy was the guy wanted for multiple murders in Seattle. He'd also killed in Utah and Colorado. Now, Bundy escaped from jail, and he was arrested a second time in Florida after a slaughter in a sorority house. He was caught by a Pensacola police officer who pulled him over for driving a stolen car. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, was caught because he couldn't keep his mouth shut and started writing letters and sending computer disks to the media boasting of his crimes. He was arrested by Wichita police, and he was nailed in court by the Kansas Bureau of Investigation State Police Crime Lab DNA test. The authorities in Kansas later more or less admitted that they had avoided the BAU and the FBI as much as possible and tried to keep them at arm's length when they tried to ambulance chase the case. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, was arrested in 2001 on DNA evidence by the Seattle PD. There may have been some involvement with the FBI crime lab on this. I don't know. I don't have time to research and write a whole book on serial killers just for this episode. I do have an interesting personal story to tell about that, which this is already running too long for me to tell. Gary Heidnik was caught in 1987 by the Philadelphia police when he very foolishly let one of his Negress victims loose to visit her family, apparently expecting her to voluntarily come back to his torture dungeon in a slum where he kept Kaffir nannies naked and shackled up for years. Jeffrey Dahmer was similarly caught when one of his male nigger homo victims escaped from being the guest of honor at one of his cannibal feasts. Apparently, this coon literally ran through the streets butt-naked and handcuffed and flagged down a couple of Milwaukee cops who forced their way into Dahmer's apartment and found, what was found in the refrigerator and the oil drums, which I won't get into. Ronald Dominique, the Bayou Strangler with 40-odd victims. Patrick Kearney, the Freeway Killer with 26-plus, all male victims, by the way, since both of these creeps were faggots. An amazing number of serial killers are actually homosexuals, but needless to say, that never makes it into the popular culture. Anyway, both were tracked down and arrested by local cops. Kearney was persuaded to turn himself in by his family. Okay, I have neither the time nor the inclination to go really deep into this subject, but on a cursory examination on the net and in the library, I can't find one single serial killing case where the FBI's BAU has actually been instrumental in catching one of these monsters. They are real criminals, and the simple fact is that the FBI doesn't do real criminals anymore. At least not when they can help it. No joke, people. They're just not that good. Their work consists of manipulating and debriefing paid informers and collecting and listening to electronic intercepts of various kinds. Telephone or bugged social clubs or cars with hidden GPS on them, like I mentioned last week. And of course, literally every email sent in this country, which they want, which they can get from the NSA. The FBI are not detectives in the real sense. They do not know how to do the type of evidence collection and collation and analysis and deduction and the just plain legwork that led local police to catch all these serial killers. Instead, the FBI is just cruising around, knocking on doors and offering people $400 a week and a license to commit petty crimes in order to become informers against the Tea Party and so-called white supremacists, as they call us, because we are the people whom the ruling party hates. That being said, we do know of some FBI involvement in famous serial killing cases. The Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, was arrested by Boston cops on an unrelated rape charge. The FBI did try meddling in this one, years after DeSalvo was dead, by casting doubt on the conviction. A man named John E. Douglas, the former FBI special agent who was one of the first criminal profilers, wrote that he doubted that DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. In his book, The Cases That Haunt Us, he identified DeSalvo as a power assurance motivated rapist. While such a rapist is unlikely to kill in the manner of crimes attributed to the Boston Strangler, a power assurance motivated rapist would be prone to taking credit for the crime. On July the 11th, 2013, the Boston Police Department released information stating that they had discovered DNA evidence linking DeSalvo to the murder of Mary Sullivan back in 1964. DNA found at the scene was a near-certain matched DNA taken from a nephew of DeSalvo. To determine conclusively that it was DeSalvo's, a court ordered the exhumation of his body in order to test his DNA directly. On July the 19th, 2013, Suffolk County DA Daniel F. Conley announced the DNA test results, proving Albert Henry DeSalvo was the source of seminal fluid recovered at the scene of Sullivan's murder in 1964, and that FBI agent John Douglas was full of shit. Well, they didn't put it that way, but I do. Now, back when he was active, Special Agent Douglas from the BAU had stepped in it once before, in the case of Wayne Williams, the alleged Atlanta child killer. Okay, on this one, fair enough, Williams was nailed partly by the BAU. FBI Agent Douglas, who had previously conducted a widely reported interview with People magazine about profiling the killer as a young black man, has admitted that when the news of Williams' arrest was officially released, and his status as a suspect had been previously leaked to the media anyway, he stated that if it was Williams, then he was, quote-unquote, looking pretty good for a good percentage of the killings, end quote. This was widely reported across media outlets as the FBI effectively declaring Williams guilty, and Douglas was officially censured by the director of the FBI. Now, as it happens, I remember that case. I followed it at the time because there was an attempt made to blame some of us for it, since obviously anyone who is running around abducting and buggering and killing little black pickaninnies just must be a wicked white racist, right? A Grand Kleagle, at least. In point of fact, there's very serious and circumstantial doubt that Wayne Williams is guilty of all the killings in Atlanta. At the end of the spree, when nobody had a clue, not the FBI or anybody else, the pattern and victimology of the killings changed. Instead of black children, it was young black males in their 20s with a history of drugs and homosexual prostitution. Williams was pretty reliably seen dumping one of the bodies off a bridge into the Chattahoochee River, and he seems to have killed two adults, but not the kids. The overwhelmingly black Atlanta PD and court system convicted Williams of two kills and closed the books on 22 more, without much evidence to support that decision. So it looks like even the BAU's greatest self-proclaimed success in profiling is tainted with affirmative action and negritude, if nothing else.
Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number, oh, they've taken away your name. Secret agent man.
You know that Joan Baez parody that somebody sent me a while back? Well, apparently there's a lot more of that stuff from National Lampoon from the 1970s, which is a time where you could get away with things that you couldn't get away with now. Anyway, this is another song like that from National Lampoon. It's called the Middle Class Well-Intentioned Liberal Blues.
I wish I was a Negro with lots of Negro soul, so I could stay true to my ethnic roots and still play rock and roll. If I was a funky Negro eating soul food barbecues, I wouldn't have to sing the middle class liberal well-intentioned blues. Intention blues, intention blues. I wish I was an Indian, a grown-up soup papoose, so when I get drunk on a beer and a half, I'd have a good excuse. I'd be a noble savage, wouldn't ever wear no shoes, and I wouldn't have to sing the middle-class liberal well-intentioned blues. Intention blues, intention blues. I wish I was a wetback on a strike in a lettuce patch, or a slant-eyed peasant with Viet Cong stashed underneath my thatch. I only ever cross a picket line to pay my union dues, to keep on singing the middle-class liberal well-intentioned blues. Intention blues, intention blues. But I am not a Negro, come on, not a red man nor a Mex, join me kids, I'm a member of the oppressing color, language, age and sex. I sympathize with the Arab cause, I feel for the put upon Jews, and I keep singing the middle-class liberal, humanitarian, meaningful dialogue. We are all responsible, well-intentioned blues. Intention blues, intention blues.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. Today, I'm talking about enthusiasm. But I also need to start by answering a question I was sent. Gretchen sent me a very interesting email in response to remarks I made on National Bolshevism. In that email, she asked a really, really good question, which will help me reinforce the main point of my real politics talks. Gretchen observed, and rightly so, that many communists are involved in or supportive of race mixing. She asked, if we were to separate communism and race mixing, would National Bolshevism become National Socialism? National Socialism, though not pushed by the party, is a racially healthy and racially correct philosophy. Therefore, the question comes down to whether or not the only racially unhealthy thing about communism is its approval of and tendency towards race mixing. Race is a product of biology. When I weigh a concept, a situation, or an action against race, I'm really trying to determine how consistent it is with biology. The most obvious example of this is my Realpolitics 4 talk on race itself. Any brief overview of history demonstrates that race and behavior are fixed derivatives of biology. Biology not only produces different races of man, but it also produces distinctions within those races. That's all well and good until someone comes along and says the distribution of results based on inherited capabilities is unfair. Granted, these abilities don't always have the opportunity to express themselves, but it's generally understood that some are intrinsically better than others. Because of these biological differences, with, of course, adjustments made for individual choices, inequality exists and always will. Egalitarians of all sorts decry this basic fact as social injustice. Communism relies almost exclusively on class warfare to drive its agenda. National Socialism, by contrast, actually creates a society where classes are distinct but unified. Various programs, particularly the National Labor Service, which the Northwest American Republic will emulate, prevent class conflicts by ensuring everyone at some point in their lives is a laborer. Historically, the distinction and friction between working and non-working classes has been the ability for higher-ups to avoid manual labor. Removing this distinction largely disables mechanisms used to instigate conflict, which is precisely the opposite of what communism would seek to do. Therefore, the answer to Gretchen's question is most certainly no. Now then, you will all have noticed that I was rather formulaic, logical, and bland about answering Gretchen's question. I understand this isn't exactly appealing to everyone, especially when certain portions of my material have been somewhat demanding of the listener, but it's necessary. I can relate to those of you who aren't exactly excited by everything I have to say here, since I'm not exactly entertained by certain subjects I need to cover either. But as I said, I do need to cover them. Several years ago, in my final term of college, I took a course in sequences and series. The concepts in that class centered around non-obvious properties of numbers, and what happens when mathematical sequences are extended to an infinite number of iterations. One particular week's lectures were especially tedious and involved. At the end of the week, the professor remarked that any student who thought that sort of tedium is what mathematicians did with their time was quite wrong. He had to cover the material because the properties of our number system needed to be understood to do other more important work. Similarly, if you think the more procedural and systematic items out of my talks are what we're concerned with, you're also wrong. I understand the lack of enthusiasm for parts of my talks, but regardless of how compressed and formulaic several of them have been, the political decisions white nationalists need to make are just as cold and calculating. Getting there involves necessarily working through material which might not have enthused you. Since you've all humored me, I'll see if I can't remedy that. But then, enthusiasm is an interesting topic. If used correctly, it can cause someone to plan and carry out sustained action which they carefully considered and decided to which they should commit. The party is frequently contacted by those who have developed some level of enthusiasm for the Butler Plan. We're always thrilled to handle these communications, even with all the time and effort they involve. When following up, we notice a few odd effects of this enthusiasm. Quite frequently, these people are so excited that they either aren't worried about following our standard contact procedures, or they can't seem to understand that they've not yet migrated. Enthusiasm should drive a person to make a plan and carry out actions they deem appropriate. But rational thought and excitement don't frequently make simultaneous appearances. We're thrilled many of you are interested in migration, but it doesn't happen overnight, so it's best not to send us emails promising you'll be here in the immediate future. We're also quite glad to hear you're excited at the prospect of white people getting their own country. But there's work to be done before this takes place, and this is frequently glossed over. Doing so constitutes obsession. Unbridled obsession is always a bad thing. Being excited about the Northwest Front is always right, but ignoring the reality thereof is always wrong. Excitement fades, and when enthusiasm is gone, it's possible that obsession will remain if someone has deliberately avoided considering their migration. Obsession does awful things to people. I admit I have an axe to grind with the rest of this segment, but it's relevant to the matter at hand. Further, everything I'm remarking on has been said in public. I'm saying so up front because I'm actually going to call someone out today. I've said before that I rarely pick on certain people, but I personally, and the party in general, have been subjected to accusations of racial impropriety which we can't ignore. Either someone takes action, or they become obsessed with some aspect of what initially interested them. This obsession leads to downright goofy behavior. I'm regularly told I pick religious fights. Most always, this comes in the form of someone taking me to task because I mocked pagans. The fact that I never have, and never will, doesn't seem to factor into this. The standard for mocking someone seems to be whether or not I take their side in an argument. Obviously, that's a non sequitur, but white nationalists have never been big on thinking things through. I'm also regularly told I must be anti-Christian, because a Christian saw me conversing with other white nationalists without demanding they convert. Much more rarely, but just as noticeably, other subjects are obsessed over by white nationalists. Any of these topics is perfectly acceptable as a field of study, since they're all important parts of the world around us. Jews, banks, usury, media, freedom of speech, feminists, economics, culture, sexual deviancy, property rights, personal freedoms, laws, and just about any other issue are justifiable things to worry about. But then again, we've all run into people who, while claiming to be white nationalists, forgo taking real action because they're cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over their pet issue. And more to the point, if you're not just as crazy as they are, you're a bad, bad person. But so what? Well, we've had another incident. This time, the party has been accused of supporting non-white immigration in the form of Muslims. Alright, I know race and religion aren't the same thing, and there are those of you who have reasonable questions about Muslims in particular. I accept that this issue exists, and would like those of you who have this concern to please just let it lie. Islam is essentially a non-white religion and should be treated as such. Harold opened last week's Radio Free Northwest episode by remarking that, aside from possibly the Boston baked bombs, there hasn't been any Muslim terrorism since September 11th, which is itself worthy of suspicion. This was taken by one particular fellow to mean that the party supports non-white, in this case Muslim, immigration. The purpose of making this remark was to point out the sham of federal law enforcement using the threat of terrorism to deceptively enhance their image and abuse their powers. As a matter of flat fact, Harold was right. The Nadal Hassan incident doesn't count because it was just one lone nut on a shooting spree. It wasn't organized Muslim terrorism such that our lords and masters could have used their secret police to prevent it like we're led to believe possible. Okay. The matter of the party's correctness having been dealt with, it should be perfectly obvious that the party is not at all supportive of non-white immigration. Why would we brush our racial politics aside for sand niggers? Well, as it turns out, the person haranguing us is a long-term financial supporter and apparently turns out some nice product, which he sends to Harold. But there's a catch. He's an outlander and is absolutely committed to remaining that way. So let's get this straight. Someone who produces propaganda for the Northwest Imperative, yet who refuses to participate therein, is so obsessed with Muslim terrorism that he feels comfortable making patently false and blindingly stupid accusations against us because we didn't address his pet issue in a manner of which he approves. Look, Guy, I'm not trying to put you under a microscope, but exactly how does someone who purportedly agrees with the Northwest Imperative, yet remains where they are despite being perfectly capable of coming home, justify coaching Harold, myself, or anyone else associated with the party to be more concerned about white people's good? You repeatedly indicated you wish we were more pro-white and less pro-Muslim, but I can't help observe that you are criticizing those of us actually trying to create an all-white homeland, behavior you repeatedly and flagrantly refuse for yourself. And if that weren't enough, how do you justify the creation of propaganda in support of something you are completely opposed to for you personally? And when the party does make attempts at performing the work you say you're in such agreement with, why are we subjected to your deliberate and bizarre twisting of a perfectly accurate historical and political observation? At best, you're looking for a reason to justify your lack of migration. If you're going that route, well, I can't stop you, since you've done well enough so far. But at least try to refrain from making allegations of racial treason you know aren't ever going to be true. You say you draw the line at defending Muslim immigration, which you know for a fact isn't something we do. The line you really draw is just before the point of your own personal inconvenience. You're probably a fine guy, and I'm sure you mean well, but you're in the process of driving yourself bonkers by obsessing over issues of Muslim immigration when there's a homeland to be created. If you ever decide to genuinely oppose white people being forced to live near the swarthy races of the world, you might spend a little time meditating on the propaganda you're so proud of. If it's actually any good, you might put it into practice. Hail victory, comrades.
Well, let me check my time here, see how that's running. Damn, I really went to town on that FBI thing in the first part of the program, so running a little long here. Think I better drop in third music break now. What to play? Hell, let's just pull one out of the hat.
Welcome to the stage, the Kingston Trio.
Okay, a quick comment here. Now, you will have noticed that last week and this week, there's a little bit less from other regular contributors on here and a little more of me ranting and raving. Now, that is not because everybody's quitting and running away or anything like that. This being the movement, I figured I'd better scotch that silly rumor right away, since there are people who listen to this show for the sole purpose of trying to disrupt it and spread disinformation. Now, it's just that it is now summer here in the homeland, and our comrades are taking advantage of the lovely hot weather to be out doing summery things, and some of them have missed a couple of weeks. The trucker's back out on the road. Olivia is still trying to cram a 4-year college degree into 2 years. Lord Lucan is involved in sports, believe it or not, so forth and so on. Yes, Virginia, we really are real people who have real lives up here. Now, that being said, this might be a good time to introduce some new talent to the show. If you want to send me an MP3 file of 4 to 6 minutes talking about Northwest migration or any racial subject that takes your fancy, lay it on me. Now I'm going to open the floor here on Radio Free Northwest to a topic that we've nattered about on here prior to this without any particular resolution, and it's a problem that's going to be very hard to solve and which can really only be solved on an individual basis, but still it's something we have to all wrap our minds around if we're going to make even a pretense of being involved in any kind of actual resistance against a genocidal dictatorship that wants to kill us all. I am talking about the problem of the party's basic approach to all this, both as a party and as individuals. I'm talking about the balance that we all have to strike in the dichotomy between the loosey-goosey, let it all hang out, I ain't got nothing to hide, man, attitude. Let's call this the Rotary Club form of white resistance. And the secret squirrel approach, wherein we basically let paranoia be our guide and assume that the secret police are watching us and plotting to get us 24/7. Both approaches have their advantages and disadvantages, and I think we need to initiate a general dialogue within our community on this. Now, after all, if we're going to be nothing but a bunch of aging white boys hiding in our little rooms with our computers, we might as well at least use the computers. It's always possible that somehow some of this internal gabbing we do might actually somehow leak into the real world and somebody might hear it, who's one of the tiny 2 or 3% of us who's still capable of performing physical acts. Okay, let's start with the basics. Last year, a young man named Edward Snowden, whom we have no reason at all to disbelieve, revealed the truth of something that we all kind of knew beforehand. The National Security Agency and the FBI are intercepting and archiving every single email, computer chat, and text message sent within the United States and Canada and most of the rest of the world. They are also recording and archiving the time and place of virtually every cell phone and landline call made in the first world for at least the past 10 years, although they're not recording the actual conversations, at least not all of them, that we know of. All of this data is being housed in 2 huge federal complexes, again, that we know of, run by the NSA with at least some FBI participation. One's in West Virginia and one is in Utah. Now, this does not mean that the secret police agencies are listening in to every word you say and reading every word you type. They call actually reading all this stuff or listening to it auditing. Now, they don't have nearly the manpower to audit everybody's conversations and text messages and emails. What that means is that should you pique their interest, they have the capability to pull your file and do a complete workup on you based on all of your emails, texts, social media posts, and an overview of your phone usage for many, many years, however long they've been doing this. I can tell you from personal knowledge that it started right after 9/11 with a program called Carnivore, with which the FBI began to intercept and monitor all email traffic. It's a program which is now probably Stone Age technology. I mean, God knows how long it was going on before that, or how many years back these archives go. However, since Snowden blew the whistle in 2013, there has been all kinds of jumping up and down from various lefties and righties all over the internet, we little bloggers and so-called journalists and pundits waving their little fisties in the air and holding their breath until they turn blue. The system has ignored them, just like they ignore big mobs of people standing in the street holding signs. Both of these things are now acceptable ways for the peasantry to blow off steam, and the system has developed a variety of workarounds for both of them. These secret police agencies know that they are completely unaccountable and that we are not going to make them stop. And they're right. There is only one way for us to make them stop. We're not going to make use of that way, and they know it, and so they are going to ignore us and continue doing whatever the hell they want to do. That's the first thing we need to understand. Until such time as there is a seismic change in the white man's character, or else until the fabled balloon goes up, they're going to keep on doing this. Anything you see on the media about Supreme Court rulings or court injunctions, just ignore it. They will. So, how does our tiny little movement, which exists about 95% on the internet, maintain even the pretense of functioning in a world where all internet is monitored, and where a lot of us like me probably even have keystroke software planted on our computers so they can monitor and archive every word we even type? Now, the first thing we have to understand is that for better or worse, the world is what it is today. This is the 21st century, until the EBT cards don't function 1 month and the black and brown rioting begins, which eventually brings down the cell towers and the internet. We're all pretty much going to have to use electronic communication of various kinds, email, text, so forth and so on. More than once in the past, I have sat down and thought about ways to try and take the Northwest Front out of the electronic world and back to paper only. This is one of the reasons, for example, that I make sure that I scrupulously maintain Northwest Observer. Northwest Observer is our backup plan. I still do use paper for certain communications, for what good that does. Since, like I said, they probably got keystroke software hidden on my hard drive somewhere that they slipped in through one of Microsoft's several government-mandated back doors for the so-called security agencies. Anyway, I do practice certain precautions, which I hope may, in fact, somewhat restrict their knowledge of my activities to something below 100%. But the simple fact is that if the secret police decide they want to know everything about me, they pretty much can. Now, the same applies to all of us. So, what do we do about it? There are two schools of thought here, and by the way, I'm grossly simplifying all of this. We're going to talk about this over the next few weeks. The first is what you might call the Rotary Club approach. We brazenly assume that we believe the Constitution is still in force, and that nothing has changed, and that we are still free to speak and write and petition for redress of grievances, so forth and so on, and we act accordingly. We therefore proceed like a Rotary Club, with formal organization and minutes of meetings and formal membership lists and membership dues, chief cooks and bottle washers and emperors of the North, open meetings and rented motel banquet rooms. Since almost no one among us owns any property anymore, and those who do aren't willing to let us use that property for meetings lest it be somehow exposed and endangered, which it might be. This racist Rotary Club does internet petitions, and we send each other a lot of newspaper clippings and internet links and alerts, a lot of talking back and forth and preaching to the choir, and who knows, maybe once or twice a year, everybody gets together, all 12 or 13 of us, and stands in the street with a sign so the police and FBI and the local Antifas can update their photo collection. Now, the Rotary Club approach generates a lot of sound and fury, which produces no change of any kind. It's kind of political busy work that keeps us out of the dictatorship's hair and gives the secret police someone to monitor and analyze and report on to justify their budgets and maybe ask for more money. In other words, the Rotary Club technique, properly done, can in fact generate a fair amount of feel-good factor among the people participating in it, which is probably why Americans prefer it. Now, we're not, in fact, accomplishing anything at all by the way of actual change, but I will concede that there is a certain salving of the conscience available through the Rotary Club approach. And let's be honest, for most of us, that's enough. This feeling that we've done our duty and fought the good fight, because I can count on my fingers the number of people in this wee little movement of ours who really do believe that we can actually win. And then, on the other hand, there's the secret squirrel school of thought, which can be summed up even more briefly. Hide. Go off the grid, hunker down in a cabin in the woods with a mountain of MREs in your old tobacco barn and an arsenal of guns under your floorboards, not one of which has ever been fired in anger at a genuine racial enemy and not one of which ever will be, because, let's face it, we're all too timid and frightened that the men in the black body armor might hurt us. Every week, you install a new encryption system on your computer because you believe the latest internet buzz about this program or that program being absolutely, utterly unbreakable. The feds don't have a clue. They can never break this one. So send us $69.99 on your credit card and download now. Look, for all I know, maybe some of these things are unbreakable. I personally think that anyone peddling any such system to where people like us can get hold of it would either have his patents bought by the government or else he'd be disappeared to Guantanamo. And of course, that might be happening all the time and we're just never allowed to know about it. Anyway, the flaw with a secret squirrel strategy should be obvious. You end up spending all your time trying to hide and protect your own identity, trying to conceal your identity from people who already know perfectly well who you are. Because 4 years ago you emailed me, or Political Cesspool, or Brother Nathaniel, or someone, and you got yourself on the radar forever when the NSA scooped up your email. And you never actually do anything, because that would mean breaking cover, even for a short time. The result is, you can't hide from your enemies, but you end up hiding from your friends. We get a good example of this every time I send out that email contact list. Only the tiniest fraction of you are willing even to list your emails so that you can meet other white nationalists and get together with them in a Starbucks or something. It's like I pointed out many years ago with leaderless resistance. In theory, it's great. In actual practice, it was an excuse to run and hide from contact with other white people and all of the bullshit that our kind of white people stir in each other's lives. It was all leaderless and no resistance. Okay, we're running long now, so it's time for me to wind it up for this week. Over the next few podcasts, let's wrestle with this interesting strategic and tactical question. Given the fact that our present situation is what it is, vis-a-vis near total electronic interception, what's the best way for the white man to build a resistance movement? Rotary Club or Secret Squirrel? And yes, it is possible to strike a balance between both. Read your 5th edition white books. Take your copy out of the cardboard box on the floor of your bedroom closet or from wherever you hide all your racist stuff from your mother or your wife. Sit down and actually read the manual. If you don't have one, email me at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I will send you a PDF copy for free. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.